Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. Today we're going to have an old friend and many-time visitor, Dorothea Benton Frank, on the show to talk about her new book, Full of Grace. And like her others, it's set in the Carolina Lowcountry. But first, your NPR News Break. With me in the studio today is Dorothea Benton Frank, and she's got another wonderful book about the Carolina Lowcountry. This one's called Full of Grace, and like her other books, all set here in South Carolina, it's on the New York Times bestseller list. And first of all, Dot, welcome back to the Journal.
Thank you.
The last time you were on the show, which was about 18 months ago after Pauli's Island, we were talking about a book that you were working on then that was going to be centered in Atlanta and deal with some contemporary social issues. That's not what we've got here.
No, forget Atlanta. I'm not allowed to write about Atlanta. It has to be the Lowcountry. That's it.
Well, the Lowcountry has really come into its own. You know, back in the 20s, it was very popular in art circles, and now people talk about the Lowcountry in New York. They talk about Lowcountry barbecue in New York City.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, it's gorgeous, first of all, and it's one of the few places left on Earth that's not completely branded into, Starbucks and Walmart. And, I mean, not that I have anything against Starbucks and Walmart, but, you know, it still has some original flavor to it.
It has some. I hate to say, go to your favorite Pauli's Island, and commercialism is creeping in there.
Yeah, it is.
The McMansions and the...
Yeah, it is. It's terrible. There's a pottery barn where Mr. Mosey Mendelssohn's bandbox used to be on King Street in Charleston, and every time I see it, I go, pottery barn, great. And then I go, oh, Mr. Mosey. You know, no one ever remember him now. It's a thing of the past.
Yeah, and of course, Charleston itself, where you grew up on Sullivan's Island, but Charleston itself has changed so dramatically since, I mean, not just the fact that there's now money in Charleston.
Right.
For the first time in 200 years.
Right, that's right. That's right. My sister would always say, you know, look at that house. You know, don't you know that's drug money? Decent people don't have that kind of money. Well, they do. They're just from Ohio, you know, so.
And they just want to live there. They just want to have a nice little place to light when they come down for Spoleto, or maybe when it's too cold in Columbus, which is.
Always.
You know, always.
Right.
You have written this new book, Full of Grace, which you do tackle some contemporary social issues. And I think we need to, for the record, that you did grow up Catholic, right?
I did.
Went to Catholic school.
I did.
The nuns wrapped your hands with the rulers.
They certainly did. You know, and told me what was the matter with me at every given opportunity, which was a lot. You know, my brother was a Holy Cross brother for many years. And my cousin is still the Monsignor of Stella Maris Church on Sullivan's Island. And, you know, my family's just crowded with clergy.
And Full of Grace, I think one of the things that when I read the book, I said I wanted to ask you, because the last couple of books we've talked about, you know, when you went to Key West one time and you saw the young woman behind the kiosk who'd worked for the Newark Star and ended Star Ledger and ended up in.
That's right.
So what was the genesis of this book?
You're going to love this story. This is a true story, okay? There's an Orthodox Jewish man in New York, has a stage 4 glioblastoma. He's had all the surgeries and all the chemo and radiation they can give him, and they tell him, you know, go make his peace, right? Uh-huh. And instead, he gets on a plane and he goes to Rome to the summer palace of Pope John Paul II and receives communion and is instantly cured. And I said, come on. I saw this on television, on the news, and I said, come on. If that's true, that's a book. What happened to this guy after this? I mean, did he convert? How did this impact his family? What did he tell his rabbi? You know, it was an incredible thing to me. And so then I started researching miracles. And, you know, the more I looked into miracles, the more convinced I became that they do happen. And they happen in every culture, in every faith. But it was interesting to me that when you receive a miracle happens to you, you don't believe in the source of the miracle. You know, so what are you thinking? What was this guy thinking when he went to communion with the Pope? So it was all kind of fascinating to me. So, you know.
Well, first of all, how can an Orthodox Jew take communion from the Pope? There had to be some kind of dispensation to give it to him, right?
I think he probably just walked up there and did it.
Oh, okay.
you know, just got online, right? You know, I guess. I mean, I don't. They didn't have that part in the news, but you can Google that to look it up if you want to verify that.
So, all of your books have had some kind of happenstance that you, as a very keen observer, just, you know, you picked up the young woman operating the kiosk, the film kiosk there in Key West, and you just saw this on the news. It attracted you, and then you dug in, and now we have a book.
Now we have a book. That's right. You know, and it was also, this book is also about Mary, not Mary Magdalene, like in Da Vinci Code. Mm-hmm. This is the big Mary.
Yeah.
You know, so.
The mother of Mary.
Yeah. And every time I turned around, there was a Mary story in front of me. In fact, I read a fabulous book called The Miracle Detective by a guy named Randall Sullivan, who, if I ever run into him, I owe him dinner big time. He's, this fellow used to work for The Village Voice, and he's kind of a New York cynic like I am. You know, I'm pretty cynical about most things, and very skeptical at least. And he was sent on assignment to write a story about the Blessed Virgin Mary appearing on the back wall of a bedroom in a trailer in New Mexico, or some crazy, you know, they have like Mary of the Underpass and Mary of the Bialy, and
and the place in Georgia where it was in the buttermilk. I mean, you know, I mean, there's right. all of this. Yeah, okay.
Was it Cummins, Georgia, where you can eat, drink, and see Mary?
Yeah,
you're right. that's a bumper sticker. It's pretty funny, actually. Anyway, he went on this series of trips. You know, one apparition story led to another one, and he began to follow all these apparition stories of the Blessed Mother. And by the end of the book, he actually witnesses an exorcism, a spontaneous exorcism that happens at Medjugorje. That was it. I mean, he converted right away. Mm. But it's, you know, 550 pages of just one fascinating story after another. It's called The Miracle Detective. Mm-hmm. You know, he can buy me dinner for that big plug, right?
All right. The fact that you grew up Catholic, I mean, obviously, at the time, you're now about the same age. You're younger than I am, but...
By a lot, Walter.
Oh, absolutely. At least 25 years.
At least 5 minutes. Right.
But the church of the 1950s and 1960s, I don't want to say it was old-fashioned, but that was, you know, the miracle. Everything was handed down, you know, like, you know, the nuns ruling with the strict ruler.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, give up everything during Lent and, you know, no meat on Friday and, you know, confession once a week and all that. Sure.
Yeah.
It was a different age.
But part of that experience comes through in your book here, because you've got... And I always love it. There's always a family from up north who sees the light for one reason or another and moves south.
Well, part of this is because of Hilton Head. I spoke to a group at Hilton Head a year and a half ago or 2 years ago, and I asked the room. I said, okay, how many? There were 500 people in this room. Can you believe that? It must have been raining. They couldn't play golf that day, so they came to see me. There was nothing else to do. I don't know. But anyway, I said, so how many of y'all are from South Carolina? And all the wait staff around the room raised their hand, you know, around the horseshoe of the room. And I said, well, how many of y'all are from Ohio or Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York? Everybody in the room raised their hand. Every single person. We just broke up laughing. You know, I said, they're doing something in Ohio. There's this mass exodus. You know, they're sort of evacuating slowly into Hilton Head. So it was appropriate to take a family from New Jersey and have them retire to Hilton Head. They thought they were moving to the South.
Yeah,
which of course is
when you live in Hilton Head, those folks really don't like to be considered part of South Carolina. I mean, I've talked to those people too, and they're wonderful folks.
Yeah,
but they talk about going off island as if when they go into Beaufort, they're going into this. You know, there's going to be a jungle, or there's going to be a passport and the gates, and you know, I mean,
I think that would suit the people in Beaufort just fine.
Oh, I think.
No, I think the only thing southern about Hilton Head is probably the humidity and the mosquitoes, you know, and some smattering here and there.
And the waitstaff.
And the waitstaff, right.
Yeah. No, I can remember years ago when they first started developing down there on the coast, I had this good old boy in one of my classes. He was the kind that during deer season, I taught a 9:30 class, he would go hunt and then come into class in his hunting clothes. You know.
God, I love it.
And
with something dead, like strapped on the front of his truck.
I never went out to the parking lot, but you could usually tell by his, when he walked in, how successful he'd been on the hunt, how he's, you know.
Right.
But he kept saying, it was almost like that thing in Pat Conroy, but he wanted to blow up the bridge to Hilton Head and blow up the bridge to Fripp, because he said, they're destroying the world in which I grew up.
Yeah.
Of course, he never did, and he's now a very successful real estate agent in Beaufort. But but there were
another
people
one sold out, right? Another person just sold out to the big buck.
Yeah. This is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Dorothea Benton Frank about her new book, Full of Grace. Again, one of the themes I like, you have a generational issue here.
Right. Well, the church that they force upon Grace is really her grandmother's church, mm-hmm. because her grandmother is, anybody's definition, she's the matriarch of that family. Mm-hmm. And so she grows up in a very Italian church of the 1950s, I mean, way before Vatican II, mm-hmm. Maybe even the 30s and 40s.
Mm-hmm. In fact, her grandmother even insists upon using the Italian version of her name.
Yes.
Much to her.
Well, she doesn't like that very much. Yeah.
But for somebody who was raised in that kind of family, she's kicked over the traces, Grace has.
Well, I think that Grace was, she's still rebelling at 31, which is pretty stupid. But there she is rebelling at 31, and she's, taking her father's money so that she can live in Charleston in the style, she wants to live in, with her boyfriend without the benefit of marriage. And so this is pretty much a scandal, for the whole family, added to the fact that he also does, embryonic stem cell research.
At the medical university.
And he's an agnostic. So all these things don't
even
help.
Even worse, he's a lapsed Catholic.
Right. Fallen away from the one true church.
Yeah. And not only that, he's not Italian.
No, he's Irish. And everybody knows in New Jersey, the Irish don't talk to the Italians. The Italians don't talk to the Irish. Yeah. I mean, they do now, but it was a time when there was a real difference.
I first ran into you think somebody's Catholic. Well, everybody's Catholic, that. I grew up in Mobile, which when I grew up was Catholic for a pretty important part of town. But most people, I think, were probably Irish Catholic in
right.
Mobile.
Few, right.
But everybody,
my family was Irish
Catholics
Catholic
were Catholics.
Sure.
But when I went in the Army, we ran into some couples who were Catholics, became buddies with. And it turned out he was Polish and she was Italian.
Right.
And when they had gotten married, neither family was happy about it at all.
Well, I don't think that my mother-in-law is still very happy that I'm married to Peter. She's Polish and she's Protestant. So, for him to marry an Irish Catholic, how the church persecuted the Protestants in Poland before the war. They wouldn't even let them put a steeple on their church. That's why they paint their doors red. I always thought it was Elizabeth Arden. It's not. Very funny, right? Oh, God. Going to get 10,000 emails for that remark.
Well, this is the first one of your books that you haven't named for a Lowcountry site. They want to keep you writing about the Lowcountry, but...
I've changed publishers.
Yeah, that's right. You're now
right.
with William Morrow.
I'm now William Morrow, and my publisher wants to try to take, my brand of writing national. Mm-hmm. And even though the place is always probably going to be the Lowcountry of South Carolina, which actually suits me fine. Mm-hmm. It's a lot less research for me, and I can concentrate more on the storytelling. Mm-hmm. I think that if they call it a low country, and it's not a low country tale like my other books, it's a little bit different. So,
yes, it's set in the low country, and I think yes, it is still a southern story.
Oh, very much so.
But, they're in the Mediterranean, they're in Mexico,
right?
And they're dealing with issues that are not. This is not just a family feud within the South.
No, this could take place anywhere.
Yeah. The best of southern writers deal with human beings who the human condition. But this is, again, I think, very uniquely southern. The land actually has a lot to do with it. The landscape still plays a big role. I mean, that's why Grace is there in the first place. She's fallen in love with Charleston and even the Lowcountry. She really likes that beautiful stretch of 17.
It's so gorgeous, isn't it?
That you drive between Charleston and Beaufort. It's just, I think that's probably the prettiest drive in the state of South Carolina.
By coincidence, I agree with you and Grace. Every time I do that drive, it takes my breath away right around Rantoul Creek.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness. It's so beautiful. Yeah. And when you go down to Beaufort and do that stretch across their causeways and the Ashpoo and the Cumbie River, and it's so gorgeous.
I mean, and just to think that people always are complaining about South Carolina's backward this, backward that. We've got the Ace Basin where all of that's preserved.
Oh, God, it's so gorgeous. There's a guy, Captain Stan, who takes you out on tours down there. He took me all around one day. Just beautiful. Things I'd never seen. And the birds. Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness. The birds are amazing. I'm a closet birder.
Oh,
way.
Okay.
No one knows this about me, but I have all kinds of binoculars. Well, now everybody knows, but anyway, that's, God, I just saw, I was out with Dana Beach, who's the executive director of the South Carolina Coastal Conservation League. Mm-hmm. We were out on a boat one day, and we saw a pair of oyster catchers. They're the cutest birds. Have you ever seen them?
No.
They have these long little needle noses mm-hmm. so that they can pop open the oysters, and they're all kind of red and orange and yellow. Oh, God, they're and black. They're great looking. Mm-hmm. little fat birds like puffins.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, cute as they can be.
And where'd you see those?
On the water.
But where?
Wadmalaw.
Okay,
Wadmalaw. On the water, yeah, around Wadmalaw Island.
Okay.
In his little boat.
Okay. Well, see, that's one thing about where your roots are on Sullivan's Island. Sullivan's is becoming so developed that the bird life probably isn't as varied there as it once was.
You know, I don't know. I see osprey all the time, mm-hmm. and I see, I guess they're hawks or falcons, mm-hmm. hunting birds, you know.
Oh, they're hawks all over the state. I mean, I went to visit a friend in Williamsburg County over the weekend, and just in a field, obviously this hawk had probably picked up all of a sudden this fabulous bird flew across this rural road, and I just stopped and just gawked because it was just...
When I was a kid, we didn't have many birds because of DDT. Mm-hmm. You know, all the birds were just about, you know, gone. Mm-hmm. And now I think peregrine falcons are back all over the place. And
pelicans also with DDT almost did in pelicans.
Right. Well, they're everywhere now, boy.
I mean, I grew up in Mobile and Mobile Bay.
Right.
There were no pelicans on Mobile Bay when I was growing up.
Right.
Because of that. Now they are nesting there again, and they're just everywhere.
No, I came home about 15 years ago, and driving down the road, and on top of a telephone pole was an osprey nest. And I remember I said to somebody, "What in the world is that?" And they said, "That's an osprey." I said, "We have osprey. What do you mean osprey?" So, you know, and there they were, just big and gorgeous.
And down there in the Ace Basin, they're bald eagles.
Yeah, yeah, I've heard that.
I was on a deer drive about 2 years ago, and didn't have any luck, and the host was upset because he wants everybody to have a good hunt. And I said,
"Kill something."
I said, "You put me in a stand a couple of hundred yards from a bald eagle nest, and I saw."
Yeah, couldn't be happier.
I said, "Man, I've had my share of deer, but to see that pair of eagles."
Yeah.
And it was just one of these gorgeous days. It was February.
God.
You know, it was cold enough to be in the woods. This is December day, excuse me, not February, wrong season, December. And it just was sunny, and the eagles, you couldn't ask for anything better.
You know, the color here and the light here is so different. It's so vibrant. Mm-hmm. And you see things, and it's so sharp. Mm-hmm. You know, the contrast of everything is so sharp, and the clouds look like they're just hanging in the sky, like mm-hmm. someone just put them up there, and the stars at night. I mean, everything here is so heightened because the light is so different.
It really is, and I think that's, we say, why isn't it the same on the Gulf Coast or in Florida? But somehow the Carolina coast is different, and I think those artists who practiced in the 1920s in the Charleston Renaissance were onto something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and of course they're now becoming very popular. If you know, people dismissed all that local color, that local art, and writing.
Right. Now you give one of your fingers away for an Alfred Huddy.
Oh,
you know, that's,
yes.
Yeah, in fact, pick a tooth. You can have any tooth in my head you want.
In fact, you know? I just looked at the new auction catalog for Charlton Hall, and he has got a slew of Huddies, Elizabeth O'Neill Verners, and every auction, I've watched them over the last year, kicking myself that I didn't buy mine a year or so ago because...
Right.
Every auction, the etchings have gone up.
Right.
I'm not talking about lithographs. These are the etchings.
Yeah.
And a number of Huddies are coming online. And when there's a Huddy oil, as there was two auctions ago, you just watch the bidding go straight through the roof.
Right. Well, it's nice to know people have an appreciation for what goes on down here.
Well,
I hear people talk about Charleston with reverence, you know, it's in the Lowcountry in general with reverence in their voice. And you should see my email. I mean, people say, you know, God, I've read your books. And one little old lady, this is so funny. I was being interviewed by a local newspaper in some little town in North Carolina. And the interviewer said, my grandmother said whenever she reads your books, you talk about food so much, she has to take a Benadryl because she's allergic to shellfish. But I get lots of emails from people that say they're planning their vacation to come to the Lowcountry because of my books. Mm-hmm. You know, I really think that the governor should buy me, you know, a tuna fish sandwich or something and a beer. What do you think? A Diet Coke.
Absolutely. We have to make sure it's in the state budget first.
That's right. I understand he's got quite a surplus. I think he's doing pretty well.
But he wants to give all of that back to the people.
Yeah.
There are a lot of things we could spend it on. You know, I was really, I don't know if you saw that the three battle flags from the massacre at the Waxhaws in the Revolution were put on sale by Bannister Tarleton's family. And when I first heard about it...
They should go to the State Museum.
Well, I called the director of the archives, and we got together and tried to see if the state could come up with the money to bid. They're going to go up at Sotheby's this month. it's probably $6 or $7 million, but it's a piece of South Carolina history.
Oh, gosh.
And I even had the director of the archives contact his counterpart in Virginia, because it was actually a Virginia regiment that was part of the fighting there.
Right.
And Virginia's House of Burgesses passed a resolution saying they should be given to the state of Virginia, but they weren't going to do anything. There was an effort to try to raise money in the state, but no. And so they'll probably either end up in the U.S. Army Museum, or my guess is there'll be some private collector who's got more money than he or she needs, and they'll just buy them and nobody will ever see them again. I mean, these are...
That's a sin. To me, that's a sin.
I mean, these are, you know, this battle helped rouse South Carolina against the British when those troops were massacred there in what's now Lancaster County. And, you know, they're absolutely gorgeous banners. And one of them, even though this was a Virginia regiment, actually has a palm. It has sort of like the stripes of the flag.
Right.
But in the field, two strange items. One is a beaver, and the other is a palmetto. Now, how that ended up in a Virginia flag, I don't know. But I thought, what better reason to have the thing in South Carolina than
I couldn't
that?
Agree with you more. If I had the money, I'd write the check.
Well, just sell a few more books.
That's right. Gotta sell a lot more books. Gotta sell a lot more books. Oh, goodness.
Well, you've changed not from having, you know, you had Shem Creek, you had Plantation, you had Sullivan's Island, you had Polly's Island. Now you have Full of Grace. Is there meant to be a double entendre there with the fact that your title, named after your protagonist, your heroine, but also the whole idea of receiving grace at the end because of the miracle? I mean, did you fully intend that to...
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. You know, I mean, I could have called it Full of Beans. Probably would have been told more about what's inside of the book, right?
Oh, No.
I mean, I think, you know, we should all endeavor to have a little more grace in our life and act in a graceful way and receive grace also, mm-hmm. you know, from up there, mm-hmm. the big guy upstairs. You know, and this is also about a struggle with faith. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, I think is interesting for me to write about, because mm-hmm. It's not my normal topic.
Mm-hmm. No, it's not. But it's I do have a number of Catholic friends who struggle with issues.
Sure.
And needless to say, those of us in the Episcopal Church are having our struggles as well with the church and with the whole question of faith. But I think what's interesting here is you've got this wonderful, talented woman who's a very successful travel guide, travel agent.
Right. She's an event planner.
Yeah, an event planner.
An event planner. Right.
And she's in this relationship with this great professional. Neither one wants to make a commitment.
Right.
Her family won't even ask him to Christmas dinner, and her brother, who's engaged to this absolute Southern bimbo.
And she's actually from Ohio. She's only become Southern since she's been in Hilton Head for a few years. Yeah. She's now the epitome of everything that's Southern.
And it takes a tragedy, but once the doctor is diagnosed with this very rare cancer, the family all of a sudden opens up.
Well, I think it's because Grace finally stands up. You know, Grace finally decides, you know, to stop rebelling against everybody, and this is what she's standing for. She loves Michael more than anything, mm-hmm. you know, more than she's ever loved anyone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she's surprised by her, you know, feelings for him, and she's gonna stand by him, and she's gonna make this thing go away somehow. Mm-hmm. You know, she's gonna love the cancer out of him. Mm-hmm. And I think when her mother sees how adamant she is and realizes that her daughter is just in love, it goes back to Al, and then it goes to Nonna, the mm-hmm. grandmother. And then, you know, when he loses his mother, I mean, that's just it. Her own mother, Grace's own mother, Connie, realizes that this is too much for her daughter to handle by herself. And she steps in, I think, you know, for the first time in a very long time, probably in Grace's life, to actually act as a mother to her.
Mm-hmm.
Because Connie's so busy feeling guilty about her own life, mm-hmm. you know, and always trying to placate her mother and her husband. So, you know, it gives Connie a chance to be a woman as well.
This is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'll continue our conversation with Dorothea Benton Frank right after this break. Thank you. Welcome back to Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Dorothea Benton Frank about her new book, Full of Grace.
I like the characters in this book very much.
Well, I was going to say, my first reaction to Grandmother was, what a harridan. I mean, she's...
She needs a tragic farm accident. You know? She needs to fall in a combine machine? That's what she needs to fall into, one of those. Oh, my God. Yeah, she's kind of a witch.
But I think she really, in her own way, dotes on Grace.
You know, I think also, Walter, people, when they find a paradigm that works, they want to stick with that paradigm. And, you know, the world can change all around you, but you don't want to change the way you live and the way you think because it worked for you. Mm-hmm. You know, and so if it worked for the grandmother and then it worked for Connie and Al, it should work for Grace as well. Mm-hmm. You know, and for Frank, her other brother, you know, it's pretty easy for him because he married a straight up the middle Italian Catholic gal from New Jersey who's a nurse.
And they got a big family.
They got a big family and they're just like doing their thing and it's like normal. You know, and if they're doing anything differently, nobody knows because they live in New Jersey.
That's right.
That's right. You know, and then the little brother, Nicky, you know, the dimwit in the family who's with Marianne, the other dimwit.
Despite the fact that he does wrong, nobody ever seems to think he does wrong.
No, because he's so adorable. I mean, how can you not love, you know, Nicky? He's so cute. You know?
But
Al can manipulate him. He's sort of Al's plaything, too.
Yeah. Well, clearly Al wants everybody to dance to his tune.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And Grace says no. You know, and I think that makes a woman out of her. And I think it also makes them respect her. And then, you know, of course, this miracle happens. And then, you know, I think it changes the way everybody around her acts because, you know, they take it from a very religious point of view. And, you know, Grace and Michael are going to struggle for a very long time to try to figure out why he received this miracle. Why him? It just, there's no answer for why him. It just seems so arbitrary, you know, that he caught this miracle like a head cold.
Well, let's talk about his catching the miracle because our tour guide event planner helps arrange the local Catholic church there, where she, in Charleston, where she's going.
St. Mary's,
the oldest Catholic church in the state, is going to have an auction to raise money. And she puts together this trip, which her dad has agreed to fund, to take a number of folks to, well, the trip is to go to
Mexico City. Yeah.
To see the miracle site there at Guadalupe.
Right. Well, that was my favorite miracle story when I was growing up. And, you know, and doing the research for this book, you know, this is the other thing no one knows about me. When no one's looking, I watch the Catholic Channel. When I'm not watching the Weather Channel and the Discovery Channel, I watch the Catholic Channel to just see what's going on. And one night, there was a fellow on there, you know, and he looks like the kind of guy that we all like to not like. You know, he's got this comb over that starts on his left ear and ends up somewhere in Fargo, you know, and he's got on this crummy looking jacket. But anyway, he's standing in front of this life-size image of Our Lady of Guadalupe and starts to tell the story. And I, in amazement, I could not believe some of the things that he said. For example, the stars in her mantle that decorate her mantle that she wears over her head and down to the floor are in the exact position of the night sky over Mexico City in December of 1513 when this miracle took place. I mean, that just blew my mind. And the fact that the bishop and Juan Diego can be seen in the iris of her eye, you know, I mean, people fainted when they realized this. So that was only discovered in the 1980s. So there are all these facts about the, I mean, I don't know about a lot of stuff about the Catholic Church, okay, but I completely believe in this miracle. And I did not before. I mean, I thought it was a wonderful story, and I thought it was probably a miracle.
Yeah, the Virgin Mary appearing to these three peasant children.
Fatima.
Yeah.
Yeah. Lourdes.
Yeah.
Fatima. That's Fatima.
Fatima, the peasant children.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. This was just, he appeared to a man.
Right. Juan Diego.
Yeah. Yeah.
Poor little Juan. Juan said, she said, I want you to go and tell the bishop to that I want to build a church here. And he said, you know, you really should talk to somebody else because I'm not very important. And there's no reason why the bishop would want to talk to me about this. So it's kind of a funny story of Juan trying to avoid taking on this hero's journey to get this church built. You know, it's a great story. It's a great story. But I'm very careful in this book also not to preach.
So this trip arranged, and it just so happens that her father buys it, right?
Right, he does. He pays for all the hotel rooms.
And it's to take a bunch of older folks.
Bunch of seniors, right.
Bunch of seniors to Mexico,
to go visit the, I guess, what do they call it? It's the Cathedral of Our Lady of Guadalupe.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out the priest they're traveling with has a friend who is stationed there and works mm-hmm. in that cathedral, and he gives them the private tour.
And Michael is going to join them there. And just before they get ready to leave, Grace finds out that Michael's tumor has reappeared.
Right.
Which is very...
devastating.
Yeah, very, very bad.
Yeah.
And they go to Mexico City, and all of this time, Michael and Grace have been talking with a priest, trying to rediscover their faith.
Well, that actually happens for Grace, because this is the first time Grace meets this priest, Father John, and he's a very cool head. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's, you know, very kind of philosophical. And I mean, I find this to be true in reality, that, you know, how I feel about a particular parish very much hinges on who the priest is, who's the priest in charge. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's what happens. She meets this very cool priest, and so she tests the waters with him, mm-hmm. with her issues about the Catholic Church. And he says, well, you know, we could talk about this. Well, you know, what you think is really not quite true. And, you know, it depends on who you ask about this, but this is what the church says. And, you know, so he teaches her to think, mm-hmm. which is, you know, something that the Italian Catholic Church of her grandmother's day did not. They taught you to accept mm-hmm. without question mm-hmm. at all. On penalty of a million years in purgatory.
So anyway, Michael decides to join her there on this trip. This must have been a real holiday for them, too.
Well, they were going to go on to Cancun for a few days.
Yeah.
He was supposed to meet with her at the end of the trip.
Yeah.
But his ticket was wrong.
Yeah.
How do you like that?
She's a travel agent. How could that happen?
Hand of God, maybe.
What makes him decide to go with the priest to the...
Because he looks like a bum if he doesn't. Mm-hmm. You know, he's just sort of going along for the ride. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that everybody would say, if you can prove to me that these miracles happen, I'd like to see the proof.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's a wonderful thing, I mm-hmm. think, to be privileged to that kind of conversation mm-hmm. with somebody who's there day in and day out watching it.
Mm-hmm. And he literally has an experience there.
He does.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'd say. Yeah. But I mean...
Hair on fire.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but as it's happening, the priest there realizes what's happening.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't think anybody else does.
No. Well, because the people movers are way above them,
uh-huh.
you know, are below them. I'm not sure which way it is, actually. I think it's below them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they can't see.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's the kind of thing where you go into spasm. And, you know, so it's...
And there's no little halo descending on your head.
No tongues of Pentecost or any of that kind yeah. of thing.
But it clearly is a physical experience. He feels
right.
within his head things.
Right.
You know.
It's a buzzing.
Yeah.
And it's heat. And he can feel it. And it starts in his ears. And then it starts from the top of his head. And it works its way down to his feet. And then just sort of like, boom, goes out of his feet.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit like sticking your tongue in a light socket.
Mm-hmm. And when he gets back to Charleston and has his MRIs.
Right. No one can believe it.
There's no cancer.
Right. How many times have you heard stories like this? I've heard so many miracle stories now. I couldn't even begin to tell you. We'd be here for a month.
Mm-hmm.
So and now people are emailing me their miracle stories, which I'm glad of. I want to put them all up on my website.
Mm-hmm.
I think they give, you know, these stories give people hope.
Mm-hmm.
We need hope, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I mean, you believe what you believe, but, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, I happen to believe these things are true.
Mm-hmm.
I never did. You know, now I have to come out and sort of make this statement. You know, well, Miss Frank, what do you think? I go, well, you know what? I'm hedging my bets, babe. I'm going to church. So you'll see me there.
Well, you're not going to do like the good 18th century Lowcountry people, though. There were those who were the good Presbyterians who also bought a pew in the local Episcopal Anglican church.
That's right, because you never know.
You never know. But, you know, it's interesting because I have talked with my clergy before. You know, the people who actually have an epiphany experience.
Right.
They say people talk about religious experiences all the time, but an honest-to-goodness epiphany is rare. And those people who have it are blessed.
Walter, I had a tumor disappear.
Mm-hmm.
I was scheduled for a big surgery to remove a tumor.
Mm-hmm.
And at the last minute, I got a second opinion from my doctor in New York who, you know, was the head of his department at Mount Sinai Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a dummy, this guy. And it was gone.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out later, a day or two later, because I was telling my editor, guess what, I'm not going to have this surgery. My tumor's gone. She said, well, you know, praise God, because I had two prayer groups praying for you, one in Kentucky and one in Texas. I had no knowledge of it. I can tell you I had a tumor. Mm-hmm. I saw it. Mm-hmm. So, and it was causing trouble.
Mm-hmm. Now, was that before or after you had started this book?
It was a long time ago. Yeah, about 8 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So Go figure.
Well, okay, but I was just saying, did that figure into this book?
Yeah, because, you know, I was reminded of so many other stories like mine from other people. You know, there's a story of, I was telling my neighbor, Mary Meehan, on Sullivan's Island, this story about a miracle that I'd heard about. And she said, well, didn't I ever tell you about my mother? Mm-hmm. And I said, no. And she said, well, they're Catholic, but they were traveling through North Carolina and stopped in a little Protestant church for a Sunday service just because, you know, the church was so charming and they didn't know where to go to church and they were driving. So they stopped in this church, and her mother had been in heart failure for a long time. And the pastor stopped in the middle of this service and said, you know, everybody hang on. There's somebody here we need to pray for. I can feel it. Let's pray for a healing for whoever is in this congregation that needs it. With that, you know, when the prayer was over, her mother took a deep breath like she was an Olympic swimmer. She's kind of like, boy, do I feel better. And so, of course, you know, she goes back to Charleston to the medical university, and they, you know, doctors examine her heart to find out that her heart muscle has been rebuilt. It's like new. And, you know, you hear stories like that all the time. All the time. I mean, these people are not liars. It's absolutely true. The question is, why them? I was telling somebody yesterday, I mean, you know, now that I have this privilege to write a book that a lot of people are going to read, you know, why me? You know, how come I get published and somebody else doesn't? So what does the good Lord want me to do with this? Well, I figured I'd write this book about Mary, you know? I'm all done with her, though. I'm telling you, I've had more trouble on this book tour than I've ever had in my life on a book tour.
Why?
I think the devil's in the details. And all the details of my trip have been screwed up, every single one of them. Day one, I leave Charleston to fly to Charlotte. It's like, you know, what, a 45-minute nonstop trip. I get off the plane. My luggage is missing. All of it. Gone. Day one of a 6-week trip. I'm like, okay, fine. So I go to wait for another flight to come in. We call Newark. We call Charleston. No luggage anywhere. So I run over to Dillard's. I buy 2 days worth of clothes. You know, I get some stuff from CVS to get through the night. Go to the hotel to check in. Room's canceled. I mean, you don't want to know. It's like a root canal. This whole trip has been a root canal.
And then they schedule you to sign books in the Columbia Airport bookstore, which only passengers with tickets can get to you.
On a Tuesday afternoon when all the flights are in the morning. Hello. It just goes on and on.
Well, since you and I share the same publisher.
But at least I got to see you.
Yeah, I know. I know. But, you know, the whole thing about PR and book tours is just, I don't know anybody who likes to do them anymore. John Jakes, for example, says he just won't do them anymore.
I'm not doing it anymore either. I'm going to go to 10 places, and that's it. I'll do a 10-day tour. Because this is ridiculous. I need my time to write.
Yeah, and, of course, John's had some health problems. He's doing fine now. But he just said, you know, this.
I'm having an attitude problem with this trip. My new publisher thinks I have a bad attitude. Well, I'd like to see them do this trip.
Well,
oh, my gosh.
I love the folks at Mara, but I must say when I first I went to my editor, and she wanted me to meet my PR person.
Yeah.
It was this little, he was going to meet me for breakfast in my hotel there in New York. Well,
right.
I go down, and I look around the lobby, and there's this
Child.
Right. Who hasn't shaved.
Right.
Who's in a baggy shirt and sweatpants or jeans or something, and this is my PR guy.
And there you are in a jacket and tie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Smelling great, looking good.
Yeah. I mean,
right.
That's, you know.
Yeah, professional thing to do.
Yeah.
Well, they hire children. They do, you know. But I have my secret weapon is up at Mara now, Buzzy Porter. I'll tell you all about him. He's fabulous.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, it's a great house.
It is a great house.
I think these publicity departments, they just have too many authors to handle and, you know, they're overwhelmed.
Well, but I will say something about it was actually the marketing people at Mara that came up with the title to my last book.
Really?
Yes.
Fabulous.
It's one of those you know, the one about the revolution, and I had a wonderful 18th century quote. It was going to be very, I thought it would be, you know, I said, oh, this is too stuffy. You've got to say it so that it will, you know, immediately it'll be on the rack in the airports and people need to know what it is. And so I emailed both my daughters, and my younger daughter was in PR out in Los Angeles, and
right.
She said, well, keep it simple for the folks in New York, Daddy. Just call it Partisans and Redcoats. Even they should be able to understand that. So
right.
They love that. And then I said, let's use my quote for the, you know, they got to have a colon.
A subtitle.
Yeah, subtitle.
Right.
No, no. And my editor, bless her heart, Sarah Durand, who's still with Morrow.
Oh, yeah.
She's now, I think, a full editor. She was an assistant editor when we started. Anyway.
Yeah, no, she's a big deal.
Yeah, and she said, well, Walter, the marketing people read your book. And I said, wait a minute. Be still
wait
my heart.
They read it?
They read the book.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the subtitle, The Southern Campaign That Turned the Tide of the American Revolution, people kept saying, oh, Edgar, you're being so chauvinistic. I said, hey, it's these New York marketing folks who read the book were convinced and that's where it came from.
Right.
So
right.
Let's not sell these people
oh,
too
no.
short.
Oh, no, no, no. I mean, Jane Friedman, who yeah. is the chairman, she is a genius, and Michael Morrison. Mm. I mean, I think she's increased their profits something like 1,000% in 5 years or something. It was crazy. You know, but they've got a lot of talent there.
Yeah.
But in publicity, it's all the same.
You got a favorite passage you like to read us?
Well, all right. How about this is kind of a fun. You want a fun part?
Yeah, let's do a fun part.
Okay. We would gather around the Thanksgiving table, and before the antipasta, the zuppa scarole, the manigot, the inevitable oohs and ahs over Big Al's bird from the grill, there would be flashes of blinding light from her big, tacky diamond, the one with one carat oval baguettes raised high in platinum in the platinum princess setting, resulting in permanent cornea damage for the whole family except for Nikki and Marianne, who would wear sunglasses to the table, and a manicure. Marianne would have had tips applied and Frenched. The thought of Marianne coming into my family depressed me, but not as much as having to be in her company for extended periods of time. As soon as she got pregnant, Nikki would run around on her with a cocktail waitress from the strip joints out at the border, running his cheap honey over to the Squat and Gobble in Bluffton for fried chicken and sweet tea, only to be discovered in a teary, screaming scene. Then Nikki would start fooling around with a newly crowned Miss Striped Bass, whom he would fall for in Manning during the week-long festival. They would soon be spotted at the Chat and Chew in Turbyville, having pancakes and coffee, discussing why there was a ban on alcohol in the town. There would be no end to Marianne's histrionics and no end to Nikki's deceit. And in 10 years, they would have 5 daughters, all of whom would be clones of Marianne. The rest of my life would be filled with Marianne's in various stages of hormonal development, at every family gathering, whining, bickering, and all of them speaking in a baby voice. Nonna would be crocheting them baby blankets and then blankets for their Barbies. Mom would be teaching them to bake cakes, and Big Al would put 1,000 miles on his Cadillac, taking Nikki out for a moment of peace over a beer in the original bars out at the state border that started the problem in the first place.
Okay.
Oh, golly.
Have you actually been to the Chat and Chew in Turbyville?
No, but I've been to the website.
Oh, okay.
So I have to buy everybody in New York T-shirts from there. They don't believe these things, you know?
Well, I was just going to say, how did you come up with it? I mean, those of us who drive to the beach know about the Chat and Chew in Turbyville.
Right.
That's on the way to Myrtle Beach.
Right.
You heard it from somebody? Or
my niece.
Your niece.
Yeah,
okay.
My niece in Savannah. She's my deep throat and all these things.
Okay.
My source.
Well, see, that's... You don't keep a journal, do you?
No.
Okay. You just keep it all up here in your head.
Right. Well, so, I do have a little book that I carry around with me, but I don't keep a journal religiously because I work on my book every day.
I mean, there are some authors who would say that you're talking to your niece and she'd say, you know, Aunt Dot, do you know about the Chat and Chew in Turbyville? And after these people, they'd write it down and, you know.
Right. Forget that?
You know, some writers, you know, do keep these journals.
Right.
I probably should.
I mean, I do write things down and stick them in my wallet, and I find them, you know, a month later, and I go, what is this? It's sort of like notes I make in the middle of the night. You know, they tell you, you know, if you have a brilliant idea in the middle of the night, like keep a little pad and pencil next to your bed. So I do that. I wake up in the morning, I look at it, and I go, why in the world would I have thought this was a good idea? You know?
Well, I keep a pad and pencil, but usually it's, you know, wake up in the middle of the night, you can't go back to sleep and think, now I need to remember to do X, Y, and Z in the
right.
morning.
Well, that's different, yeah.
I'll write it.
Yeah, that's different. I do that too.
Yeah. I have had very few brilliant ideas in the middle of the night.
I've
in the shower, perhaps.
In the shower, right, in the bathroom mirror.
Yeah.
That's right.
Occasionally have one and I start thinking too much and cut myself.
Oh, no.
All right, well. Full of Grace is very much a Carolina story, and it is set in the Carolina Lowcountry, as have all of Dorothea Benton Frank's other works. It is got lots of good eating, particularly if you love Italian food. And it's got, I think...
I'm going to be Italian in my next life.
You can be Italian in your next life.
They tell me I could pass now. I could pass for an Italian.
You don't use your hands enough when you talk.
Not in the studio.
My dear friend Patricia Hatcher at USC, who's going to retire shortly and who's managed all of my grant accounts. I mean, she is an Italian from the coast just above Boston. And is she an Italian?
Oh, gosh.
Love her. But every time she talks about, you know, first of all, she had to chew me out because there was not enough about Italians in South Carolina in my book. And I
right.
said, well, until you moved into the state, there really weren't many.
She's
Italians.
The other one. Right.
Know?
That's right. There are two.
What's the next book?
Next book is called Cordially Miriam.
Cordially Miriam.
Cordially Miriam. She signs herself Cordially Miriam on all of her thank you notes. Miriam rises in the morning to begin the pleasant task for her of writing her thank you notes with a fountain pen on her crane stationery.
Okay.
Yeah. And Miriam is just a little bit too prim. Mm. And Miriam's mother lives on Sullivan's Island, and she's gone green. Miriam says she's a hippie, but she's not really a hippie. She just keeps chickens and goats.
Oh, okay.
So she likes to go fishing and hang out at Bert's Bar and tell stories. And she used to be the grand dame of Charlotte.
Of Charlotte.
Yeah, and she kind of threw it all away to retire to their family home on Sullivan's Island and stop coloring her hair. So it's the daughter being completely demoralized by her mother's behavior, only in the end to find out, gee, maybe mama got it right. So,
but now please,
it's a fun story.
All right,
fun story.
But please, in your book, do not discourage people from writing thank you notes.
That is
about the one thing that we here in the South.
It's still left, right?
Still left.
Oh, gosh. And don't do it by email, please.
And it makes a difference.
It does. It makes a complete difference.
Years ago, when I was visiting professor at Middlebury and had my daughters with me, they were then 10 and 12. And I was working with the local museum there, too, trying to help them get some stuff done. And a trustee invited us out. He had a home on Lake Champlain. This is wintertime.
Right.
But he owned the cabin where Ethan Allen had started out his, you know, to go to
no
Fort
kidding.
Ty. And so they invited us out for a lunch and then cross-country skiing, which we did. But my girls got home and they wrote thank you notes.
Sure.
Anyway, this woman called up. He was a retired Wall Street broker.
Right.
And she kept saying,
I can't believe.
Right. And she said, I just want you to know that your daughters are welcome at our house.
Anytime.
All they got to do is pick up the phone and say
sure.
they want to come. And
isn't that nice?
Yeah, it is. And
isn't that nice?
And actually, you know, I didn't.
On Christmas, my mother wouldn't let me play with my toys until I wrote my thank you notes.
Well,
seriously.
That's.
It was okay.
You know.
I got them done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I had a friend in the last year say, please tell Amelia not to write me another thank you note. And I said, you know, I'm sorry, but, you know, Sally, but that's just the way she was raised. And she's going to write you a thank you note, just, you know.
Right, right.
But anyway, some people can't overdo it. They thank you for thank you notes.
Right. Well, that's sort of what Miriam's doing.
Okay.
But Miriam gets her act cleaned up. You know, she straightens out.
Okay. We're about to run out of time, Dot. Anything you want to share with our listeners before we sign off?
Oh, gosh, no. Just thanks for the emails, you know. And if you have a miracle story, please send it to me at dot@dotfrank.com. It's my email. My website's just dotfrank.com. But
then the dot is spelled out.
Yes, it's
D-O-T,
period.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's D-O-T, the little, what do you call the little thing?
At.
Yeah, at sign.
Yeah.
Dotfrank, D-O, oh gosh, sorry. Dotfrank, period, C-O-M.
And, of course, we will have a link from our website here on the Journal to your website, so people can, if they forget that, they can.
Yeah, if anybody wants to come to the airport and see me sitting there doing nothing today, that'd be great too.
Well, Dorothea Benton Frank, author of Full of Grace, a novel about the Carolina Lowcountry, even though William Morrow wants to make this a national story, that's fine.
It's ours.
It's ours.
Yeah.
Thanks for being with us again on the Journal.
Thanks, Walter.
This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. As you can tell, Dot Frank and I have been friends for a while, and so we had really more of a conversation about ourselves as related to the book than just sticking to the book. So those of you hoping for a complete synopsis of her new book, Full of Grace, will be a little bit disappointed on that score. But one of the joys of doing this show is getting to meet people like Dot Frank. And when we get together once or twice a year, sometimes for publicity purposes, sometimes just as friends, to be able to have a conversation and to let it ramble as you would on your front porch on a warm summer evening with some good sweet tea or perhaps something a little bit stronger. And Full of Grace is a book that you should enjoy on your front porch or on the beach with a cool beverage this summer. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal. If you missed any part of today's journal or would like to listen to it again, go to walteredgarsjournal.etvradio.org and you can listen to it online. That's walteredgarsjournal.etvradio.org.